This is a global production.
I have been put in to a radio station to secretly produce a programme for a presenter who didn't want a producer in the studio and didn't realise that's what I was actually doing. So I was making sure we hit timings and read out the ad reads in the right way and promoted competitions correctly. But that was, they were never told that was my job on the programme. They thought I was just a co-presenter. And they would quite often go, I don't need you. I could get you sacked just like that. And I was thinking, no, you can't, actually. But that was an interesting dynamic.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ian Dale All Talk podcast. I'm Ian Dale. Today we're going to talk to somebody who, if you've worked in radio news over the last, well, shall we say couple of decades, possibly a little longer than
that,
you will probably have come across Sandy Waugh. It has been said of her by Frank Skinner that she has the best voice in British radio. And I'm trying to think of people that have better voices, but I'm not sure I'm coming up with a long list here, Sandy. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a delight to be here.
I've been wanting to do this for some time, but we don't really cross over very much in the LBC newsroom, but we did a few weeks ago. And I said, do you want to do the podcast? So here we are. How did you get started in radio?
Oh, gosh, it was by accident, which an awful lot of people will tell
Same
you
here.
When they start. Although my family will tell me I was always destined to be a journalist, because I was born at home in the days when home births were probably more common than they are now, but a bit early and no one was quite ready for me. And they wrapped me in newspaper because the blankets weren't available. And they said, destined for a career as a journalist, either that or a fish and chip shop.
So no, I'm trying to imagine which newspaper it would have been.
a good while back. But that didn't resurface really until I got to university. I was thinking I was on a path of being a performer, musical theatre, and all my teenage years were spent backstage in the local theatre doing pantomime and musical theatre and so on. But when I went to university, I accidentally discovered journalism. I was writing theatre reviews for the newspaper. This was Hull University. And a student came into the newspaper office to say, we need action on something that's affecting all of us as students. And in those days, they had this crazy system where the student residences around the campus were halls and they were segregated, men and women. And the men's houses had blue curtains. And the women's houses had pink curtains. Yeah, it really, really was that. And what was happening was all the neighbourhood nuisances.
This was the 1870s.
Exactly right. The neighbourhood nuisances knew which houses were full of single women.
Oh, and God, yes.
Yeah, so I just ran a campaign through the student newspaper to, can we just swap the curtains over and mix them up? And the university went, oh, OK, good idea, and did it. And I thought, wow, if I write something, I can make things happen. I can change things. Oh, the naivety of that.
Well, but, so I suppose you didn't go into politics.
Well, no, I think I'm temperamentally not suited to politics. But that was what first exposed me, if you like, to journalism. And then I did the standard postgraduate training and started work. My first paid job was Radio Mercury down in Crawley, the heart of the South, reading the news there.
And did that come about by accident, in a way? I mean, did you always want to do news?
No. I news reading, which is what I ended up mostly doing, was absolutely not what I wanted to do, because you'll know it's probably the least interesting job of all the things we
Never
do.
Never done it. I've always wanted to do it.
Trust me, it's not. News anchoring is a bit different when you present the whole programme. But I wanted to be the person that went out and asked the questions and was at the scene of the stories. But I was at the launch of Radio Mercury, so the 2 weeks before we went on air, everyone did everybody's jobs. And I was the trainee, the junior that was meant to be doing just the vox pops and the little bits and bobs. And they said, oh, go on, have a go at reading the news. And I was given this news script. I was shaking so hard. And this is in the days when we used paper. All you could hear was this paper shuffling on the microphone. But it worked. And they went, oh, newsreader. And that was me destined to do that from day one, in a sense. So I was a frustrated reporter, but I ended up being a news presenter and news anchor sort of by accident.
I was listening to Fee Glover and Jane Garvey's podcast recently, and well, I listen to it every day, actually, but they had an episode where they spent 20 minutes talking about their early days in local radio, which would have been late 1980s, Radio Wyvern and GLR and all of that sort of thing. And they were talking about the technology which I think for the students that you teach at university now, I mean, they wouldn't recognise a 1980s radio studio,
absolutely.
Would they?
Absolutely. When I started, we had no mobile phones at all. It was typewriters with carbon paper and Tippex. And in the corner of the newsroom, you had the teleprinter that would churn out what we used to call the rip and read. So it was sent from London. You could literally tear it off the machine and go in and read it. And they had this alarm system that if something significant was happening, it would beep at you. And I remember one of my vivid early memories, which will probably date me a little bit, was that this machine started pinging and it got so dramatic. It was bouncing itself across the floor with the alarms. And this was the Brighton bombing.
Oh, right.
And we weren't yet on air, but we were sort of practicing how we would have responded to that. But the technology was slow. That gave you the headspace, I suppose, to check things. One of the early jobs we used to do was the round of check calls, where you would pick up the phone and phone the local police station, ambulance control, even the council, and go, anything happening? And so you had to build a relationship with the police. And of course, one of the challenges I have with my current students is you can't even find a phone number to call anyone anymore. No. So it's actually such an old-fashioned way of gathering content. It was slower. We only had 3 bulletins a day. You'd have to wait to lunchtime to get an update. And it was a totally different way of thinking about how news integrated into the output.
So over the years, I mean, you've just given away when you really started out there. I mean, over the years, have you found adapting to technology easy?
Some, very easy. Increasingly less so, and we maybe come back to this later, but this is, I think, right now, the point in my career where for the first time I felt that I either need to step back and really retrain or make room for someone else. Because the technology and
that.
The media consumption has changed so much in the last 4 or 5 years. And the way audiences find us and the way we need to find audiences, what skills we need to teach, the nature of the students I'm working with and what they think journalism is so radically different. And it's a mindset thing as much as it's a technology thing. We can all learn to use different types of software and we can learn to cut audio digitally rather than with a razor blade. But this completely different way of thinking about what matters and how we should present news, I'm finding quite challenging for someone in my age group, because it's a huge gap between me and Generation Z, as I insist on calling them.
Quite right, too.
And Generation Alpha, who's coming down the pipeline.
But do you find there are certain parts of the of technological advance that you just don't want to be a part of? That you think, OK, other people can do that. I'm going to trust them to do that. I'm not going to make any effort to learn this.
TikTok is mine. I'm sorry, that's an awful thing to admit, isn't it? I'm very much of an audio journalist. And I actually even resent the fact that increasingly cameras are in our radio studios.
Oh, don't get me started on that.
And part of our presenting is looking down the lens. It's like, no, I actually want to concentrate on what I'm doing.
Do you ever think if I'd wanted to be on TV, I would have been on TV?
Absolutely. Time Out used to do a feature called Good Face for Radio, because it was the line they often used at us. And I was featured in it 3 times.
Really?
And I did wonder if someone was trying to tell me something. It's like, you're particularly good face for radio. But it is different and it does change things. And the great cliche about radio is Alistair Cook, the legendary Letter from America presenter, used to say the pictures are better on radio because we make them ourselves in our own minds. And I think once you start putting pictures in front of people, it does change the way you do journalism and tell stories. And I think as a podcast enthusiast, visualizing podcasts is the work of the devil. But that's another conversation maybe.
But that is what's happening. And I know it's about to happen to my podcast too.
There is a lot of discussion in
the
industry.
It will be visualised within a few months.
It's one of these things.
you got in under the rail.
Just about, yeah. The trends have very strongly, as you say, been towards visualisation as a way of discovering podcasts. So people will find you on YouTube. And in America, that's the number one platform now for YouTube. And actually with my students, that's the first place they go to find content is YouTube. So if you're not there, you're missing connecting with a particular type of audience that you wouldn't connect with before. But there are problems about building content for visual media when you're mostly an oral tradition, not least its control of advertising. It's who, how your content is placed. I have a friend who makes a podcast around breast cancer, and they don't want to put it on YouTube because they then can't control the products that are advertised around it, and they're very concerned ethically about what's placed next to their podcast. So it's problematic, but yeah, it's the direction of travel, and yeah, I didn't want to be on telly ever, so I don't want to be forced to do it by the back door.
Right, well, let's move from Radio Mercury. I mean, looking through your CV, I mean, you've worked in a huge number of places, both national stations and local. What was the main challenge as you moved through your career? What was the did you always have an idea of what you wanted to end up doing, and did you have a plan of how to get there?
Absolutely no plan ever at any stage along the way. Pretty much every opportunity presented itself to me. I mean, that I don't wish to dismiss that, because actually some of that is about getting yourself out there, making contacts, being known, doing consistently good work, and then people approach you. But I didn't have a plan. I didn't think I'm going to do local radio for 5 years and then national radio and then progress onto this. Some things happened sort of by accident. And I happened to be at BBC London when 5Live was launching. And I just thought, oh, I'd quite like to have a go at that. And made a sports programme, and they liked that, and they hired me from it. So some of it was in the moment, recognising a moment and going for it. But a lot of it was just people launching something and going, you might be a good fit, and hiring you across. When I first joined Talk Radio, when it was Talk Radio UK, before what it is now Talk Sport, I really didn't want to go there. I was at the BBC. This was in the 90s. I was supposed to be going to the Barcelona Olympics as part of the BBC sport team. Fantastic. So I was really set. I was learning judo to commentate.
Which, in those days, and we ought to point this out, for a woman to do sports programmes, I mean, that was quite unusual.
Yeah, it was quite a big deal. And to try and get high profile in that sport. And they'd given me judo, netball, but netball wasn't an Olympic sport, and a few other things to learn so I could get into the sport. And then Talk Radio said, no, come and present a programme for us. And I kept saying, no, I don't want to. And they kept saying, no, really, we do want you to, and offering me more money. And so in the end, it was literally too good an opportunity to turn down. So some of these moves were happy accidents, if I can put it that way.
So you were at the beginning of 5Live. I mean, how long were you there for?
I did a programme called Women on Top, which in itself is an interesting problem.
Now, would that title get past the more wokey sort of people today in broadcasting? I doubt it.
And it's the whole debate that people used to have around Woman's Hour. And it's, why do we have a programme called Woman's Hour? And why do we consider some issues women's issues and men's issues and so on? And the conversation has moved a long way from that point. And some of us that contributed to Women on Top were going, no, this is slightly cheapening the treatment of women's sport. But it placed it, and it got it on the dial, and women's sports broadcasting has beyond recognition transformed since the days when I had some of my battles at places like TalkSport, where there are some mornings I'd be the only woman on the floor, and football managers, who shall remain nameless because I'm being nice to them,
come
into the building and look across the room and go, hello, love, could you make me a cup of tea? And I'm going, no, I'm actually, that's not my job here. I'm actually your news presenter. You know, you do have a producer whose job is to make a cup. And they were really thrown by what role I was in that environment.
So what did Brian Clough say?
Never met him, sadly.
Well, that you would remember if you had, I think.
It's obviously a really bad impression of the person I was trying to give you the clue to.
But, I mean, just on women in sports broadcasting, what's your view on, for example, in football, where it now seems obligatory, when there's a Premier League match on, you have to have the, I'm going to say obligatory rather than token woman, on the panel of pundits. And on women's football, you sometimes have male commentators. And I'm thinking, well, should it be like that? I think male football, and they are the same sport, but men's football is different from women's football in a way. So why would you have a woman pundit who's never played the men's game? And similarly, why would you have a male pundit who's never played the women's game?
It's a big argument, isn't it? And it often creates dramatic headlines when people react to it. My take on it is, if you want a sport to be inclusive and welcome everyone and make it accessible to everyone, which for mainstream broadcasters, that's what they want to do with sports coverage, then you should be representing everybody's view on watching sport. Now, I happen to think that women watch sport slightly differently from in my experience. I'm a season ticket holder. I go to football all the time.
Wimbledon.
AFC Wimbledon, the mighty AFC Wimbledon League One. So we are a little fabulous story.
Just avoided relegation, am I right?
Just by the skin of our teeth, oh my. But I do think, when I have conversations with people in the pub afterwards, that what I like about football is the sort of theatre, the drama, the stories, the personalities, the sort of trajectory, the story arcs, there's the journalist in me talking like that. My husband, who comes with me, it's like statistics and how many goals have been scored and what strategy was used. And I do think there are different ways of looking at the sport. And sometimes I think having that different mix in the way you present it can be really good in bringing that inclusivity in. There is an argument that I do have some sympathy with, that if you're really trying to analyse tactics and strategies, if you've not played sport to the level that you're watching, it can be hard to analyse it. I used to commentate on cricket. That was one of my heritage sports. My grandmother was a cricketer. I adore cricket. But I think with the way technology now can show you the flight of the ball and the angle of the spin and all of that sort of thing, I don't think I could now be an analyst on cricket coverage, because I could do a reasonable, decent swing bowl, but I could never spin the ball and I can't explain what's going on there.
So cricket's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I, in a way, Test Match Special, I think that probably made me love radio more than anything else. But I don't think the Test Match Special people of the 70s and 80s would cut it nowadays. Even though they all had great anecdotes, they all had fantastic voices, they held your attention, particularly when there wasn't any cricket to commentate on. I haven't listened to it for a long time, and I just wonder how different it is now.
I think it's a continuation of it, because I think they've understood, and in some ways it's similar to how some of tennis commentary is carried out. In the moment of action, it's very intense and quick, and you've got to be really agile to be able to describe it. But there's lots of periods when nothing's happening, and that is when your storytelling and connection with the audience comes to play. Because I think what Test Match Special established, which a lot of other radio programmes have tried to build on, is understanding the audience and having the relationship with the audience and having that, getting people to contribute. It's a club. And the best podcasts are clubs, and the best radio communities know each other and feel like they understand each other. It can be worrying when you're a radio presenter and you get birthday messages from people and you think, I've never told anyone when my birthday was, and they add it up from the things that are said about you. Sometimes slightly freaky, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? And the visualisation of radio has now increased this, in that people always think that anybody in the media is desperate for recognition. But sometimes it can be quite intrusive when somebody stops you on the street and they will tell you, they say, still own an Audi, Ian? How are the Hammers doing? What are your two dogs like? And it's because, I mean, I've mentioned all of these things on the radio, but you do get taken aback slightly sometimes by people who do that.
And it's a big part of what we're wrestling with in educating journalists now, is how much of yourself should you put out there and how much of yourself can you protect? Given the direction that things like podcasts, social media, influencing is moving, where the product is you.
Yeah.
Not even your story, it's you. You're building a follower, and therefore you've got to create an image and an impression and put yourself out there. So some people take the approach that they have an online or an on-air personality that is not the same as their real person.
And
that
works.
Doesn't quite work. Very few people it works for. An example I was given, I was talking about this just last week with a media psychologist. There is such a thing.
Oh, my God.
And he was giving the example
field day with me.
Of Freddie Flintoff. So lots of us know Freddie Flintoff. But, of course, Freddie Flintoff is not Freddie Flintoff. He's Andrew Flintoff. And they say it was a really deliberate thing that he put Freddie out there as his media persona, which meant Andrew Flintoff was not the person being criticised and slated in the media.
I could never do that. I know well, I won't say who it was, but a presenter who used to be on LBC, who did the same thing. And I could never understand how he got away with it.
It's incredibly hard to sustain fake, because what people pick up on and relate to and why they like listening to you is because they think it's real and you're really talking to them. But it has real implications, particularly for young women, that as soon as you put yourself in the spotlight, there is a whole chapter of abuse you will get. Terrible things get said about you in social media, and you have to work out whether you're even prepared to go there and put yourself out there. I used to, I'm naturally grey now. I stopped dyeing my hair. This is going somewhere, don't worry, before you wonder what I'm talking about. And I used to read the news on TalkSport, and that was on camera. And the number of comments I would get from TalkSport listeners about who's the bag lady in the corner and what is she doing there? She needs to tart herself up. And it washes off me, because I'm old enough and ugly enough not to care.
Could either dye.
But yeah, but it is a real challenge for some young women to find themselves suddenly being got at by people who think they have the right to criticise you for not what you're doing, not your job you're doing, but who they think you are. And that's a real problem with the way our media is moving.
Let's talk about some of the famous people that you've worked with and read the news for. On your Wikipedia entry, it mentions that you were you worked with Chris Tarrant at Capital.
Yeah.
You must have some stories with him.
Oh, Chris was a joy to work with, but also a terror to work with. Very, very perfectionist and very impatient of other people's, what he perceived as failings. And I remember taking over from a chap called Chris Cardell, who'd been reading before him, and another chap called Mark Sandell. And they both said to me...
Fellow West Ham supporter.
Big, tall,
West Ham
fan.
6'6".
And they said, Chris will take the mick out of you over something. So they gave me a really good tip, is basically offer him something that he can take the mick out of that you don't mind and is not going to bother you. So I had thought about this. So I turned up the first week I was news reading. I turned up in a different sports top every day. So a football top or a cricket top or I think I even had a Pringles golf jumper at one point. So he got that I was a sports fan, and he would completely rip the mick out of me every time and put me on the spot about sport. But that was absolutely fine, because it was nice, safe banter, and it was we had a nice bonding over that. But he could be quite challenging if you weren't properly prepared and weren't in that same space as him. And like a lot of personality presenters, woe betide you if you tried to deliver the punchline on any joke.
You see, that's a really interesting thing that you've said there, because I think that a really, really top presenter is actually going to want to encourage other people to be funny as well. And I remember going on This Morning once when I think Eamon Holmes and Ruth were... No, it was Eamon Holmes and somebody else. Anyway, it's my first time on This Morning. I was quite nervous. And I thought, I mean, you know when you've done well and you know when you haven't. And I came off that set thinking, well, they'll definitely have me back. And they didn't. And it was because I had delivered a punchline to an anecdote which Eamon Holmes thought I must have rehearsed. And I genuinely hadn't. It was just a funny moment. And he didn't like it.
Mm.
I mean, since then, I've met Eamon Holmes sort of in other environments and gone like a house on fire. But I was actually, I couldn't believe that he would react like that. Whereas if it's me, I want my guest to do well, because it reflects well on me as the presenter of the programme if the guest is doing well.
And I think sometimes it's a relationship you build with them as well. I read the news for Colin Murray for a good while. And Colin would really like it if you would just give him a sense of what your lead and final story would be on any bulletin, so that he could have that conversational shoulder to go into the bulletin and out of the bulletin and not create a big faux pas moment. And he would be very happy for me to play with the bulletin as much as I liked and be funny, as long as I'd warned him, and then he could work out whether he wanted to crack a joke going into the bulletin, which is always incredibly dangerous if you don't know what the lead story is.
Particularly if you've got breaking news and it's a tragedy.
Exactly that. And gosh, I've had my thunder stolen so many times. I remember GLR, when sadly we were announcing the death of the Labour leader, John Smith. And all we knew at that point was that he'd collapsed at the Barbican Centre and had been taken to hospital. And I can't remember, I genuinely can't remember who the presenter was. But now, so we cross over to the newsroom for a breaking news story that John Smith has collapsed and died at the Barbican Centre, Sandy. And it was like, there's nothing else to say. I say? So it was one of those lack of communication moments when they walked all over you. But a generosity of spirit is quite precious in double-headed programmes, isn't it? I worked with Paul Ross for many years, one of the most generous co-presenters I've ever worked with. Really happy for you
another
to be.
Another West Ham fan.
Well, there you go. It's obviously something about that part of London.
There's a lot of us around in radio.
Yeah, he absolutely loved having you be a very much an equal partner, which I still think it's really annoying that very often you get male-female teams and the female is the junior. It's still there sometimes and really shouldn't be.
And also, nowadays, well, certainly on LBC, it's the only station I've worked for, but we don't have the newsreaders in the studio anymore, which I rather regret. When I started, the newsreader would come in at the top of the hour. I can't remember whether they did the half-past ones or not. And you can sort of bounce off each other. Well, you can't do that, and it's now designed in order that you can't do that, I suppose. But I slightly regret that.
And some of that is just a reflection of the logistics of the way newsrooms, news hubs, as we now tend to call them, have to work, that newsreader may be providing bulletins for several stations.
Or they might be in
the
in
family.
Leeds doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to do Sunday afternoon bulletins on another network, and I would do bulletins for five different networks, which meant they had to be recorded, which is horrible that you record a news bulletin before the news goes out. But it's just the economics of how some of that has to be staffed.
So when you went to Talk Radio, I mean, there were some pretty high-profile names there at the time, weren't there? Kelvin McKenzie was running it.
Yes.
I remember going, it was Lorraine Kelly.
I used to cover Lorraine.
I was a guest on her show.
It was Steve Wright.
You must have got some anecdotes from that period. I mean, it always sounded a bit as if it was a completely chaotic station.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are really, really not repeatable.
Go on.
Editorial meetings, when the controller changed and when Kelvin McKenzie took over and he went round the room going, what the do you do? You're rubbish. And just intimidated the heck out of absolutely everyone. And I suspect some of that was working out who would actually stand up to it and answer back. And of course, that was a way of managing media that's increasingly, fortunately, not the way we deal with it now. You don't bully people into submission and manage them and you do it this, you know, my way or the highway. That's quite rare these days. But I remember my very first bit of work experience was actually at Time Tees Television. And I was sat at the early morning newsroom meeting and they went round, as they usually do, who's got a story, who's got the lead, who's going to work on this, that and the other. And they got to the end of the meeting and they went, this is Sandy, a student, another student. We know they're all a waste of time, but, you know, she'll probably leave before the end of the day. But here she is. And he took me to one side and said, by 1 o'clock, full TV camera script for our lunchtime news on my desk. And I didn't even know what a TV camera script was. So I had to go round and bother people who were working to find out. And I did it, put it on his desk, and he looked at it and he ripped it up and threw it in the bin. And then he leant over and shook my hand and said, OK, right, so let's see how we can make this work for you. And it was his test. What a terrible way to treat someone who's...
That is bullying, isn't it?
Terrible, terrible behaviour. Yeah. But it was seen as OK. And mercifully, we're not like that anymore in most places.
But there are moments in every newsroom, even now, where there can be heated moments.
Yeah.
And I think they have become less over the years. But it's a live broadcast environment. And if a presenter feels that they're not being given the support that they need, particularly with breaking news stories, that's when things can get very heated.
And if you're co-presenting, who gets to read the big moment?
Yeah.
That's
enough of the Today programme. it is true, though, isn't it, that sort of some co-presenting teams really work and others don't. And in some ways, the ones that don't, you think, well, there must have been a reason that these two have been put together. So why doesn't it work? In the end, it's got to be all about personal chemistry.
Has to. Although I was put together with one presenter back in the early days of Talk Radio who... I loathed him and he loathed me. And actually on air, it was quite creatively interesting. But it was a really uncomfortable experience to be working with someone whose entire philosophical approach to early morning radio was so different from mine.
Have you ever been put together with someone quite famous because the station actually just wanted that person because they were famous, but they were absolutely hopeless broadcasters?
No, I don't think so. Because usually I was the newsreader, yeah, and then the sort of the co-presenter. I have been put in to a radio station to secretly produce a program for a presenter who didn't want a producer in the studio and didn't realise that's what I was actually doing. So I was making sure we hit timings and read out the ad reads in the right way and promoted competitions correctly. But that was, they were never told that was my job on the program. They thought I was just a co-presenter, and they would quite often go, I don't need you. I could get you sacked just like that. And I was thinking, yeah, no, you can't, actually. But that was an interesting dynamic.
It's only happened once with me where Tessa Jowell, who I absolutely adored and would be a regular guest on my show, she'd left the cabinet or left being a shadow minister and loved LBC and was desperate to present. And I did a couple of Sky News paper reviews with her and it was fine. And then they said, well, she wants to come and do an hour with you every week. I thought, absolutely fine. But it's a bit like my mum. When she took a phone call, she'd suddenly put on this posh voice and it just wasn't her. And Tessa was like that. And I kept trying to sort of coach her to, no, you've got to sort of be yourself. And she'd like, in the break, she'd be her hilarious self and tell dirty jokes or whatever. But on air, it was like she was putting on her telephone voice, and it just didn't work.
It's a thing that lots of students do when they start. Because I voice coach, I teach our young students to be news presenters and news readers, and they do sit there and go, "Here is the news," and you're thinking, "What are you doing? Just be yourself." But there is a perception that there is a good voice for radio, and that if you haven't got it, you needn't bother. But actually, as we know, there are thousands of good voices for radio. It's about how you use the voice you've got and how you communicate and how you tell stories, because that's fundamentally what it's about.
Let's talk a bit more about podcasting, because you're doing a PhD in, what was it, podcast education?
Yeah, at Citizen George's. I've been there for 27 years now, believe it or not. We increasingly started to realise that audio journalism, news, traditional newsroom radio journalism, was only meeting part of what students needed to know. So we started experimenting with teaching podcasting and realised how difficult that is, because it's so many things. 4 years ago, I launched a master's degree in podcasting at City. So it's a specific degree in it. And off the back of that, it's thrown up all sorts of thoughts about, is it radio? Is it video? Is it social media? Is it alive? What is podcasting? What is it becoming? Because it's changing at the speed of light. I'm trying to write at the moment a chapter of my PhD on defining our terms. You know, what is podcasting? Nobody agrees. There is no definition of what it is. And every time I try and write it, it moves. You know, something pops up here and makes it different. And that in itself is quite interesting, because it's going through a sort of media cycle that lots of media does. It starts off as this disruptive, entrepreneurial, little individual enterprises, very low entry point, doesn't cost anything to get into it. And then people start to realise it's powerful and it makes connections and it bypasses some other media formats. And then the big players get involved and start investing in it, and you've got Netflix making big podcasts now. And then suddenly the little entrepreneurial creative just is disappearing out of the equation. It's becoming another mainstream media, arguably.
What's happening to podcasting, I think, is exactly what happened to blogging. When I was a bit of a first mover in political blogging in this country back in, 2003. And by 2008, all the newspapers decided that, these people who do these independent blogs, they're not saddos who sort of failed journalists who just write stuff in their bedrooms. They're actually breaking stories. Well, we need a bit of that. So they instructed their journalists to start a blog on their own websites. And it eventually led, I think, within probably 3 years, to independent bloggers either disappearing, or it was very difficult to break into and get an audience. And I think that's exactly what's happening to podcasting now. If somebody, an ordinary member of the public, decided to start a podcast now on whatever subject, unless it really was groundbreaking, you find it very difficult to get any level of audience.
What's worrying me about some of this, though, is where social media news influencers are fitting into this. I was at an interesting research seminar in Las Vegas just recently, and they're a bit further down the path than us about all of this. And they were talking about how the coverage of the news anchor's mother, who's disappeared, and her name is escaping me at the moment, but how the coverage of that has become a continuous live streamed news influencer, true crime investigator phenomena. And what's happening with young people, with Generation Z, and they think increasingly Generation Alpha, is they're the people that young people are looking to explain what's going on in the news. And a lot of them have no journalistic training, no understanding of the ethics of what they're doing. Obviously, if you're covering a crime story, there are all sorts of implications if you get it wrong and you amplify misinformation in the way that a lot of these people do. And yet that's where a lot of people coming in, even into university journalism courses, that's what they think news journalism is. It's, and I talk to students when they join and say, why do you want to be a journalist? And it always used to be, I want the front row seat at history. That was the line I always got. Then it was, I want to understand what's going on in the world. And now it's, I want to tell people what I think. That's what they think journalists do, which some journalists do. But you need to then understand the boundaries of that and the ethics of that and how that operates. And I think that is a real threat to what journalism is and is doing and how that relates to all the big picture ways of how society functions and democracy and so on.
And of course, nowadays, most people of that generation, they get their news in 90-second chunks on TikTok or Instagram. And that, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be if it's, if the people creating the videos either have a particular axe to grind which they're not giving the context for. But then again, you have brilliant, there's a guy, I'm trying to remember, is it Kalen, an Irish guy, who spent like 3 months in Ukraine reporting on it. I mean, clearly, I don't think he's got any journalistic qualification, but he's absolutely brilliant at it.
The research that I was seeing suggests that this age group really does want to know what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
But what it wants is it wants to understand it. And I think they think that what a lot of us in the media have been doing is assuming people understand what these stories are about. They assume we understand that if there's a war in Iran, that's affecting petrol prices, and they want to know the why. And I think that's where media needs to sit back in and go, OK, we need to explain the why better. And actually, that's what podcasting can do so brilliantly, because it's got time.
Yeah.
If you get the right people on and explain things in a way, and that seems to be where there is an appetite, which is a really good thing, I think.
And one of the great things about podcasting is you're not hemmed in by a radio format. There's the return of the long form political interview, which podcasting has brought about rather than anything on the mainstream media. And it's very rare, unless it's a really, really big name, that I can justify doing a half hour or hour long interview live on the radio. But that's why I do this podcast, because I can do 2 hours if I want to. And I had Neil Kinnock on, not intending to do 2 hours, but he was just being brilliant. And I thought, well, what's the point in ending this when he's being brilliant? The only reason we ended it at 2 hours because Andrew Marr needed the studio, which is very annoying. But, I mean, that is a massive advantage that podcasts have, isn't it? And I've never had anybody say to me, God, that was a bit long, Ian. Can't you do it a bit shorter?
Yeah, the first time I presented a podcast, it was actually for The Guardian. I did a podcast about the Rugby World Cup. I have done lots of different things. And I remember saying to the producer, give me a clue, when you want me to hit the break. And they go, what do you want about? It's a podcast. I'm like, oh, yeah, of course, I don't need to know the clock. I don't need to understand what the timings are. I just need to think about making sure it's interesting. That's the, when people say to me, how long's a podcast? That's always my answer, yeah. As long as it's interesting.
And do you find that you are now listening to podcasts like in the car more than you listen to live radio?
I listen to live radio at home. I listen to podcasts when I'm commuting. And as someone who lives and works in London, I spend a lot of time commuting. And I think that's true of a lot of people.
I can remember when Jackie Smith and I started doing the For the Many podcast, the people at Global said, right, 22 minutes, because that's the average length of a commute. And I thought, no, we're not going to. So over the course of the first few weeks, we got it up to an hour. Nobody ever complained about that. And I'm thinking, well, OK, you your way to work is 22 minutes, but you've got 22 minutes on the way home as well. And if you make a good podcast, people will want to listen for that length of time.
Yeah, that's the joy of it, isn't it? You can stop it and pick it up at any point that you like. And you can rewind and listen again if something doesn't make sense. And I know you can do that with radio as well, but it's a different... It is a whole different mindset, telling a story in that format. What I love, what the students produce for me on the Podcasting MA, is just these wonderful creative ways of telling stories that are very much audio that you would never be able to do anywhere else. Last year, one of my students did an investigation into the migratory path of the turtle dove.
As you would.
As you would. And where else would that sit? And it was beautiful. And the thing is, they fly over Malta, some of them. And in Malta, you can shoot them.
Yeah. Oh, no, I did know that.
Oh, there you go. And she did this beautiful thing about what the turtle dove symbolises in different cultures. Yeah. And it's a symbol of love. And yet this bird can be shot at. And the ones that migrate in that pathway are in danger. And you think, where would that sit? And it was full of music and sound effects and bird song and absolutely beautiful.
See, Radio 4 wouldn't do that, would they?
No, probably not.
You've obviously taught a huge number of broadcast journalism students over the years. My producer, Corey, is one of them. Do you derive a lot of pleasure from seeing people that have sort of come through your course and then 10 years later, they're editing this, they're presenting that, they're producing this, and... I mean, you must get a lot of people coming to you saying, well, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, it's very, very touching. And it's an enormous privilege to know that you just opened the door for some people. You know, the really talented people, you just need to point them in the right direction. There are some who come in who never even thought radio was a thing. I get this with new first years. They don't listen to any radio. And by the end of it, they're absolute radio converts and they walk into careers in radio. And you just think, that's a wonderful...
Why would you be doing a broadcast journalism course if you didn't listen to radio?
Well, our undergraduate course is just journalism. Right. So we get students that want to do photojournalism or magazine journalism, or they want to write, or they want to make web content or TV. Very often, radio is not on their radar at all, and podcasting to some extent. But very often, by the end of it, the third year, we let them choose. And the number of them that choose to do broadcasting is a great thrill to me, because we've taken them from don't know, don't care into, oh, show me, because I might want to earn a living doing it. And that's wonderful.
Is it more difficult, do you think, to get into broadcasting in general now than it would have been even 10 years ago? Because I think a lot of broadcasters now do insist that you have some sort of broadcast journalism qualification, which obviously you would think was a very good thing. But there are people who are very talented who haven't necessarily done a qualification, but you can just see the raw talent there. For them, I think it's much more difficult to get in now.
I think it depends how you're defining working in broadcast journalism. If you're talking about a conventional sort of radio, TV, digital, social content, yes, undoubtedly, I think there are, the pathways are more constricted, they're constrained than they used to be. And not least because so many local, small newsrooms don't exist anymore. So the opportunity to get it wrong and have nobody notice, which is an important part of learning, is much harder to do. I think that the worrying factor is that because so many people do require you now to have the legal and ethical training and understand the technologies and so on, it is increasingly a graduate entry, and getting a degree does tend to narrow down the economic diversity of the students we get, the geographical diversity. Even I teach at City in London, and we know we have a challenge with the fact that it's in London, and an awful lot of people cannot afford to spend 3 years living and studying in London with the way student grants and educational funding is going. Oh, don't get me started on that one. But our universities are in a terrible, terrible mess. And if we value the contribution they make to life in general, it needs looking at.
Let's finish off by talking about things that go wrong and memorable moments, sort of huge news events that you've been fortunate to be at the centre of, well, not the centre of, but covering them. Let's start with that first. Give me your three most memorable on-air moments where you've had to read a bulletin, where you know that you have to get it right, you know that you can't afford to show any sort of emotion, or something where it's just for no apparent reason, something's gone horribly wrong?
One that really sticks in my mind is LBC News, when it was called News Direct, we were on air. I used to present the nightly news, which was simulcast on both LBC and News Direct, on the night of the London bombings, 7/7. And there was a real awareness that lots and lots of people needed us to tell them, was it now safe? How can I get home? How can I find out if my loved ones were involved? How can we understand what's going to happen tomorrow? How can we just get a sense of community and understanding? And I remember thinking at the time, because it was all very, very mad, as you might imagine, we were trying to fill a live hour, things were still developing, we had some amazing reporters out and about on the scene, and we also had an amazing influx of global emails from people saying, London, you know, we feel what's going on. And I remember having this amazing sense of calm that I need to be really the quiet centre of this story, to go, just stay with me, trust me, we're going to get you home, we're going to let you know what's going on. And it was an extraordinary privilege, I think, to be on air at that time and to know there was an amazing team working on the nightly news at that point, helping support that.
You basically the anchor?
I was anchoring it, yeah, and just trying. And we, those are the sort of programmes you can't plan.
No.
Because you don't know what's coming next. And you know there's a certain amount of content that has already happened that day. Ken Livingstone had spoken and Tony Blair had spoken and the police had been speaking and the ambulance services and all of our reporters. But it was still moving and it was still changing. But the initial shock had somewhat settled, I think, at that point. And then there was a sense of sort of anger and confusion as to what was going on and how do we get information about who's been injured, who's been hurt, who's been killed in all of this. So it was you felt like you're in the controls of a big battleship, if I can put it that way, and trying to make sure it stayed on course. It was extraordinary evening.
Have you ever got emotional on air?
Not on air, immediately afterwards, because I don't ever want to make it about me. And I think if you get too emotional, you pull focus from what you're trying to talk about.
That's exactly what I used to think, until I did get emotional on air once, and I apologised for it. And my screen was flooded with people saying, please don't apologise. We were reacting in exactly the same way.
It's always context dependent, yeah. Isn't it? That sort of thing. I remember I went out to the refugee camps in Turkey on the edge of the first Gulf War, and I went across the border into Iraq, and I remember doing a little documentary for Capital Radio at the time and meeting people who were in just the most desperate situations. And I met one woman who was 7 months pregnant and had walked for 7 days with her toddler and she was about to give birth and the baby was in breech position, and she said, I don't know if I'll survive. How can I give birth like this? And I captured this content and brought it back. And funnily enough, it was hearing myself reporting it that made me just lose it completely, because I then went back imaginatively and realised what I'd seen. And I know I did a good job reporting it, but I'd kept it slightly at an arm's length, I think, and all of that, and got very emotional afterwards. And I do think, actually, that there's much more acceptance now than there. That was in 1991, 92, I can't remember now.
91, yeah.
And I think now it would be more acceptable for us to be, as you say, affected and impacted by what we're hearing. And there's an understanding that, of course, we are. We've done a lot of work around resilience and mental health in journalists. And there's a whole organisation called Media Strong that comes to City each year and looks at some of these issues and has investigated, for example, the impact it had on all of us that worked through COVID, day after day, telling awful, horrendous, heartbreaking stories, and being in the sense of fear and we don't quite know how it's spreading and what's going on, not knowing how to cope with it ourselves, and yet just continuing to do that job, it does grind you down.
I always feel really guilty when I say that I had the time of my life during COVID. I did 140 shows from my bedroom. Doesn't get more intimate than that. And I remember the first day back in the studio and the energy that I got from being in front of the microphone again in the studio. It was like someone had put a cattle prod up my bum. And it was just almost a different style of broadcasting.
Yeah. Well, I commuted into, I was at working at Talk Radio at the time, so I was commuting to London Bridge and working in that great big tower building on the 14th floor, and I was the only person in the building apart from the sound engineer at that point. And it was the weirdest experience and quite very confronting to be travelling home on the train when you're literally the only person on the train. Yeah. And although I did, I had one of those little passes that said, "This is, you are a key worker," which I felt slightly cheeky because, you know, compared to the medical staff, really, what we'll be doing. But I was desperate for the police to stop me and saying, "What are you doing out and about?" I was going, "No, I'm allowed. And it never happened.
So I've always wanted to be breathalyzed. Never happened because I don't drink, so wouldn't have anything to fear. What's the worst thing that's gone wrong when you've been on air?
Oh, I mean, there's so many sort of technical breakdowns and computers breaking and just things, kit being spilt and drink being spilt on kit and so on. The one that caused me the most panic, I think, was I was for LBC broadcasting from the Millennium Dome, as it was called then, on the night of the Millennium. And we hadn't thought it through properly, but they threw to me and I was sort of left talking for 20 minutes when nothing was happening. And it was, I was really challenged to come up with no one to talk to because no guests had turned up. And it was one of those things I'm thinking, what can I say next? And it, because lots of people hadn't turned up because they were stuck at Stratford Railway Station. Right. And it was just... And I've never listened to that back. I would never want to listen to that back because I'm sure I talked absolute drivel even more than I usually do. But that sense that you've just got to keep going because you've got to get to midnight because, you know, midnight's the moment.
The same at the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics where we were told that we were, because we hadn't got any rights to do it. So we were told, well, you can cover the Olympic ceremony, but like 20 seconds behind. I thought, that's ridiculous. So, of course, we had a television monitor, so I just did it from that. But we were told that we'd be able to see the stadium from where we were in the Westfield Shopping Centre on the balcony of a casino.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you could if you walked up the other end of the balcony and sort of turned round to the left. And it rained and we had a gazebo and I found I was sitting in water. The communications with Leicester Square went down during news bulletin. I mean, if you'd been, that would have been, I tell you now, if you'd been part of that programme, that would have been your worst moment because the newsreader would read a lie. And why the newsreader was even there, I don't know. And they didn't know when the package had finished that was being played out.
Oh.
So it was just a nightmare.
No.
And that was my first outside broadcast. And I remember going back home in the Addison Lee with my co-presenter, and we just sat there in silence. But the listeners really enjoyed it, because listeners love it when things go
they
wrong.
They love it when we mess things up, don't they? One of my biggest disappointments, I was part of the BBC team covering Harry and Meghan's wedding out at Windsor, and I was on the processional route, and we had it all set up. We were outside a pub, so we were piggybacking our signal off the pub's Wi-Fi. And I'd done all these little pre-pieces and vox pops and so on. So they handed to me for commentary as the coach came past. And at that point, all signals dropped. Everyone's signals dropped. And we think it might have been a security bubble. As soon as the carriage passed, it was all back again.
Oh, right.
But my big moment was taken away from me. And I never got to do my commentary of Harry and Meghan's wedding. What a loss, hey?
Absolutely. How things might have changed.
Who knows?
Sandy, we have to finish there, purely because I've got to do another podcast in a moment. Otherwise, we could have rabbited on for another hour at least. Sandy Ball, thank you very much indeed for joining us on All Talk. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do leave a positive review wherever you get your podcast from. And join us again next week. Goodbye.
This has been a Global production.